And you're back with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast. And we've got Ben Hodder on the line. I probably said that completely incorrectly, so we'll justify my pronunciation in two shakes.
Hi, Annie.
G'day, Ben. I couldn't rouse anybody else, so you're going to have to be the sole spokesperson here, okay?
No worries.
Okay, now you're from Unions for Palestine.
That's right. I'm a member of Unions for Palestine, yeah.
Yeah, and there's been a picket down at Webdock. It's not the first. It's about the third, actually, and it was targeting a Zim ship. Now, can you tell my listeners, just for those who aren't around the issue, why it was significant to be targeting a Zim ship that was coming into Melbourne Port?
Well, Zim is the Israeli national shipping line, and after October 7th, Zim made statements that it was throwing its weight fully behind the military efforts, as Israel characterizes it, in Gaza. And so the Federation of Palestinian Trade Unions and many other groups, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions campaign and other trade unions and union and advocacy groups globally have called on unionists and activists to boycott and picket the operations of Zim Shipping because it's part of the, you know, genocide supply chain. As we heard last night from the ICJ, genocide is occurring in Gaza, and Zim Shipping is, you know, one of the main, points of that supply chain.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's about actually having an effect on the commercial enterprises of the capitalist system. I mean, they're involving themselves in genocide. They're pretending that it's not happening. We've got people dying every second of breath. And then they just want to have this song and dance to slow down general observation of what's going on. But it's impossible because of social media, for a start.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, you will hear as well in the coming days and weeks when the question of what happened down at Port Melbourne over last weekend and into Monday is, you know, being questioned and discussed. You will hear a lot of bad faith reportage and commentary saying, oh, well, they claimed to be stopping the export of weapons from Australia to Israel, but that's not the case, or we don't know that that's the case. That wasn't the claim. That's never been the claim. We don't know what's in any one shipping container that comes off or goes on to a ship, any ship, Zim or otherwise. Even wharfies haven't received the manifests of shipping containers' contents for decades now, since that law was changed, and that's no longer, you know, those manifests are no longer provided. We don't know whether one ship is containing weapons or parts of weapons. The call from unionists and the boycott campaign inside Palestine and in the Palestine advocacy kind of space globally is interrupt the supply chain, as you put it rightly. Interrupt the flow of capital into and supporting the current genocide and the genocidal acts that have been ongoing since the Nakba, since 1948, and in fact before 1948.
In fact, it's quite extraordinary the level of power that the Zionists employ throughout all the media as well as through government's connections. The standing there in a community picket down at Webb Dock is one of many ways that the community can stand up against this barbaric act.
That's right. And, I mean, I also have some experience in the local council organising space. So I'm a resident of Darebin City Council. And here in Darebin, we had to fight very hard back in December to get councillors to recognise that the will of the community was that there be a strong motion passed on Palestine, raising the flag, committing to council divesting. So again, that interruption of the, you know, the financial capital flow there, divesting from companies and super funds complicit with Israeli genocide and occupation, illegal occupation under international law, apartheid.
And there can't be business as usual. There can't be business as usual.
There can't be business as usual. And in the process of all of that activism, we had, I mean, just to give a really concrete example of what you've raised in terms of the pro-Israel lobby, we had, you know, unanimous support, except for one councillor who absented herself from the chamber to avoid having to vote at all. We had unanimous support for that motion. And then when the motion came to bring the flag down, and was passed initially, we had the JCCV, you know, well-known right-wing pro-Israel lobby group, crowing on social media the very next day, saying, we've had a win in Darebin, the Palestinian flag is coming down, and that is because we successfully lobbied the deputy mayor, Tim Lawrence. So that is how the pro-Israel lobby operates. They do it shamelessly. They publicize the fact that they have lobbied individual politicians. They, you know, they will be working for sure on even activists within the space that is organizing these pickets. They're working on, you know, they're doing their best to work on any actors in the space, union officials, politicians, of course, local, state, federal politicians. Now, in the event, Darebin for Palestine and the community there was able to push back. We mobilized midsummer. We mobilized the Aboriginal community in Darebin, who both said, you know, the queer and Aboriginal communities both stood up and said, not in our name will this flag be removed. That's a bad faith, you know, attempt to wedge these struggles against each other when, in fact, they're united. But the point is that the pro-Israel lobby is
very
in
strong.
Overdrive now,
yeah,
trying desperately to turn this narrative around and, you know, get little wins where it can. But
well,
frankly,
no, what
they're
doing effectively
desperate.
Is dividing the conversation into all these little splinter fragments when in actual fact people are still dying in Palestine.
That's right. And, you know, to come back to your point earlier, talking about what Unionists for Palestine have been doing at the docks, it's the third action that Unionists for Palestine have initiated. But it's not the third picket. It's the first successful picket that we've been able to establish. And that's because the first two actions were, I mean, the first one was a protest, a rally, that did manage to get some symbolic win in terms of delaying the ship.
Yep.
Because, you know, the pro-Israel lobby and Zim's operations specifically, they're basically the same thing, but they're watching very closely what's happening here in other parts of the world where Zim operates and has to dock. To do trade, they're watching very closely, and they were watching already back in November, I think it was, when the first, you know, quote unquote community picket was established for several hours down also at Webb Dock, and because they can see that a protest is happening, they changed the schedule. So the ship was not, you know, the ship was due to arrive the first time that Unions for Palestine organized an action, and then by the time the action came around, the shipping schedule had changed. Now, shipping schedules also change for operational reasons that might be independent of actions, but by the second time, this was just, you know, later in December, that was a picket that was called by UFOP, that's how we refer to it, as a shorthand, and that was of the Zim ship, the Sparrow, the Zim Sparrow.
Yeah.
Now, we announced that picket maybe a week or a week and a half in advance, And a few days after we announced the picket, we can see, because they're, you know, they're tracked with GPS, we could see the Zin Sparrow halfway to Melbourne from Sydney do almost a 180 degree turn in the water and go back up to Port Kembla and sit at anchorage in Port Kembla. It can't dock in Newcastle. Port Kembla is one of the ports of Newcastle. It can't dock there. They don't have the facilities to unload large container ships, and it was due to Melbourne anyway. It can't, you know, I mean, docking in Sydney wouldn't make sense. It just sat there and waited, and it costs them thousands or tens of thousands of dollars a day. The one figure we've heard is $11,000 an hour that it's delayed. It just sat there and waited it out. Eventually, once the rally happened, it happened at the docks. It was a great success.
But that wasn't Webb. That wasn't down at Webb Dock, was it? That was
the second one was not at Webb.
No, that was at Appleton. Yeah, yeah, and much harder to get to.
Right, it was a bit hard to get to, and you know, Unions for Palestine is also learning like what it means to try to establish effective community pickets at the dock space.
Yeah,
or multiple dock spaces. So the first one was really, I think we probably used the language of a picket, but I'm not sure we did actually. It was an action at the dock when a ship was due to dock.
Yeah,
and that first action gave birth to an occupation down at the docks that later became Block the Dock.
Yeah,
that was the name of that.
Which is a great name, I'll have to say.
Ongoing action, I love it too. And Riyad Al-Adassi, a nurse from Gaza who's been, you know, quite an important figure in this movement. And it's a shame that Tasneem is not here with us. Tasneem Samak from Free Palestine Melbourne, you know, is one of many Palestinian activists on the ground here in Melbourne who have been absolutely central, of course, in this organizing. And I want to speak to what happened with this picket. So at the first one, which turns into an occupation after unionists are like, okay, well, we've had a successful rally. We've turned around some trucks that have Zim containers on them. That was a symbolic kind of moment that was reported in Al Jazeera and across the world. But it was not yet... an effective community picket of a worksite such that a ship could not be loaded or unloaded.
Right.
Then the second action happened, as you said, at Swanson Dock on Appleton Road. That one was also advertised in advance, and the Zim ship turned around and waited it out. So that was a significant win, but again, because the ship never got into the dock, we didn't end up able to picket the worksite and prevent it.
But this one down at Webb Dock was that started on the Friday?
Started on the Friday, and the key thing here is that we took our cues from comrades in Western Australia in Fremantle, Unions for Palestine there, supported, I understand, although I'm not really across the on ground operations there, but significantly supported by organized socialist groups there.
Yep.
They realized that the key, if the picket was going to be effective and not tip off Zim shipping in advance to just turn their ship around and put it at anchor and wait until the planned action passed, we had to not advertise the picket, you know, much more than 48 hours in advance. So with this third one, we decided to publicize it about 48 hours out.
Yep.
It already established, a way of communicating directly with fellow unionists and other concerned community members who were prepared to put their bodies on the line on a picket. And we organized all of that and mobilized all of that such that Zim shipping was not tipped off in advance. and the ship was basically already in Melbourne. It was so close to Melbourne that it didn't make sense to turn it around. And the picket was established on the Friday, and it was, you know, established in very large numbers to begin with, but close to 200 is what I have kind of heard. It's very hard to know exactly these numbers, but so that was unionists and a broad coalition of groups and individuals across the community.
Yep.
And as I said to people on the Sunday afternoon, when the huge Sunday rally had been told and invited by a number of speakers, Declan Ferber-Gillick, that I think you might have mentioned earlier on the show, who also unfortunately can't be with us for this conversation, but you know, has been on 3CR last week and is keen to kind of keep having these conversations about what happened with Declan, Nasa Mashni, again Tasneem Samak, had been asking the rally, come down to the docks. You know, this started on Friday afternoon. It's now Sunday afternoon. That's 48 hours. That's quite possibly, I can't say this for sure, but it's quite possibly the longest successful picket of a dock worksite in Melbourne's history. I've heard, and I can't be certain, but
someone out there that's going to be able to tell. But I tell you what, what happened between 4:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Monday, the 22nd, the way the police behaved was extraordinary.
Well, the police behaved with Vic Police, including the port,
critical,
the public order response team,
the
riot cops, essentially. Behaved with the same kind of heavy-handed brutality that we've come to know them for. Monday wasn't the first time. They tried to clear the picket at least three times prior to that.
Yep, tell us about that.
Friday night, riot cops were in there trying to establish a corridor to get workers in. They managed to get a couple of cars, but they weren't wharfies in those cars. They were refrigeration workers. Saturday morning, they came back. There's basically two shift changes on the dock, 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. So 6 p.m.-ish on Friday night, they tried to establish a corridor through the picket to basically break the picket and get workers in, and they essentially failed. They certainly failed to get the workers in who were necessary to unload and reload ships at berth, and that was the aim of the picket very clearly from the beginning. So that failed, even though they did manage to get some cars in. Saturday morning, they came back, and under powers that are unclear to me and that are subject to review currently by the Melbourne Activist Legal Service, MALS, in terms of what were the powers that police were acting on there, they read a move-on order. And despite having previously told us that move-on order on the Friday night was based on the Traffic Act and that therefore simply standing off the road and not blocking traffic would have meant that we were not subject to any move-on order, not arrestable, etc., they attempted to kettle the entire picket and clear it, not just off the road, but off also the grass area, and acted with extreme aggression, with the liberal and trigger-happy use of pepper spray. One arrest was made, and that person was in fact taken into custody, later released, but, you know, very, very aggressive, and for many activists and unionists on the ground, very disturbing behaviour, which actually caused quite a lot of people to feel that they couldn't remain at the picket and be safe. Now, fortunately, about 20 people were stationed at a different gate of the terminal, the Victorian International Container Terminal, VICT. So they weren't kettled out, and a number of other particularly nimble comrades managed to avoid the kettling, and then a number of the rest of us who had been kettled and cleared decided, okay, we've been pushed out, but we're not going home. We're going to go round the back, and we're going to, you know, come back to the site and see what we can do. And what we could do was that the police had eventually left. They again didn't succeed in getting any workers in, because our understanding is that wharfies at that site, backed by their union, said, it is not safe for us to cross this picket line. It's an OH&S hazard, and that is, you know, it's our right under industrial legislation to refuse to go to work under, you know, those kinds of conditions, OH&S hazards. And they repeatedly, this is what we understand, of course, I'm not a member of the MUA, I'm not a wharfie myself, but what we understand from the rank and file is that they were refusing to be forced by the bosses to be escorted by riot police into their worksite, as if that was a safe thing to do. We also understand that WorkSafe made a ruling that no, indeed, it was not safe, and that therefore the bosses' attempts to stand those workers down without pay as a kind of punishment, you know, just don't, wouldn't fly legally. And so no wharfie has been docked pay.
Well, you know, there's something about
just to finish the narrative about the police brutality, we re-established the picket on a Saturday morning. We called out as many activists and community members as we could. And from that point onwards, it remains something that individual Unionists for Palestine activists and organizers were involved with, but it was no longer primarily a Unionists for Palestine picket. It became a genuine community picket at which Palestinians, Arab and Muslim community members, anarchists, socialists, communists, all kinds of people that had never been at a picket or never imagined themselves to be involved in that kind of activism, suddenly, you know, became involved. We had the motorcade come down from Faulkner.
Yes.
We had a lot of children there. It was often a really kind of, you know, a carnivalesque, a wonderful carnivalesque atmosphere down there, with music and speeches and food being shared around, people meeting for the first time. So that was reestablished on Saturday, and that held throughout Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, Sunday. On Sunday afternoon, the Free Palestine Melbourne big rally on, you know, the weekly Sunday rally, yeah, was called down to the docks, and really a goodly number of people turned up, so that by Sunday afternoon we had some 200 again people down there. And there was a further attempt on Sunday afternoon to get workers in to again establish a corridor through a different gate. They really just pulled out all the tricks that they knew. And each time, we're talking about, you know, somewhere around 40 riot cops by my eye. You would have to look at the Mal's report probably to try and establish numbers more clearly, but, you know, at least 30 riot cops. And on this occasion, on Sunday afternoon, I would say probably that number again of so-called ordinary cops. So that's getting like 50 or 60 cops down there, which is a huge deployment. Yes. Again, they failed. Again, scenes of absolute jubilation at the repeated victories of the community picket over Victoria Police's attempts to clear it, to break it, and to, you know, to force wharfies to go to what we had established as an unsafe worksite, which, you know, I'm sure your listeners will probably be aware, is really the only way that the community can establish that it and workers do in fact have the right to strike, which the International Labour Organization has said that Australia does not currently enjoy,
yeah,
because
right,
of the nature of the Fair Work legislation, which is similar to other legislation that's been in place in Australia in the past. For instance, when Clary O'Shea organised the you know, and many others, of course, organized the strikes that, that were also at that time, quote-unquote, illegal, illegal according to Australian legislation, but possibly...
morally not illegal.
Morally legal, and even under international... Now, under international law, there is a right, there is a right to strike, and that right has been abrogated by the industrial relations legislation and framework in place in Australia that, you know, that limits industrial action to protected bargaining periods, that in fact even makes any hard picket illegal, even if you are in a protected industrial, you know, in bargaining.
Well, it's
strictly speaking illegal to hard picket a work site, but, you know, unions still do it because unions understand that often the only way to challenge these laws is to break them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like tying somebody up and then saying, defend yourself, defend yourself.
Well, right. And, you know,
it's outrageous.
Unions and the community won't, it is outrageous, and unions and the community won't stand for it. But we have to work together because if individual workers were at this point in time to say, I'm not going to work a ship that is supplying genocide, we know it's genocide now, it's established. I mean, we knew it before, but it's now established in international law, in the international discourse. No one can legitimately argue any longer that what is happening in Gaza and the West Bank, frankly, is genocide. But, you know, what came before the court was the Gaza case and, you know, the case of the Palestinian people as a people.
Mm.
So it's genocide. And if any worker... individually or collectively, were to say, I'm not going to work a ship that is supplying genocide, Australian law gives the boss the right to fine that worker hundreds of thousands of dollars as an individual, and that tallies up to, you know, fines of millions of dollars for any group of workers, including a group represented by a union, that would take that kind of principled as you said, moral stance in terms of their workplace organising.
Oh, in solidarity now, with their compatriots in another
absolutely.
Country.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in response to their fellow unionists' call to do just that.
Exactly.
So that's why the community needs to step in and say, all right, well, we will establish the picket. We will make it unsafe for you to go to work because that is, you know, that's the loophole through which workers are able to stay away from the work site, that's right. And, you know, this was a community picket that lasted from Friday at around midday or 2 p.m. through to Monday, 4 or 5 p.m., as you said, to come full circle now, the fourth attempt.
Which was just extraordinary.
Extraordinary, and, full disclosure, I wasn't down there at the time. I was at work. As were many people, and my understanding is that although many people were on the way to the docks because the clever community organisers who were there on the day had decided to call a rally at the picket for 5 p.m, we in Darebin for Palestine had relocated our rally, which was to be at the Darebin City Hall, down to the docks to also try to boost numbers. Because, you know, the coda to that story is that we had a win against the pro-Israel lobby and managed to keep the Palestinian flag flying in Darebin.
Yeah.
But at the time that the riot police attacked, having installed on Sunday night a camera inside the terminal but right next to where the main picket was being held so that they could constantly surveil the picket and know precisely when the numbers were at their lowest ebb, around 3:30 on Monday afternoon, picketers numbered around 20 across both gates, so very low numbers, and the police attacked, and what we multiple reports confirmed that there were at least 200 police on the ground. That is the MALs, the legal observers have told me that represents more or less the maximum possible deployment of Metropolitan Victorian Police, riot and otherwise, so port and standard police, that could be deployed in any one moment. And cops outnumbered picketers about 10 to 1.
Yeah, I'll just remind listeners, you're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and I'm talking to Ben. How do you say your name?
Well, my family says horse, which is itself a butchering of the Danish pronunciation.
Don't worry about it. Yeah, well, Ben, and we're talking about what happened down at Webdock, the community picket, and we've now arrived at Monday where the police are 10 to 1. Versus the picketers.
That's right. And so a lot of people were arriving in the period that the cops were attempting to clear the picket, but they were being denied access, again, on questionable legal basis, because what the cops started to do after their first failed attempt to clear the picket was to get someone from the Port Authority down, clearly under police instruction to do so, to read a trespass notice to picketers assembled. And then on the basis of that being read, the police could then read a move-on order on the basis of the trespass notice that had been given. But that the trespass notice has to be given in person, and it has to be given by the, you know, quote-unquote owner of the land. It can't be given by police themselves. Right. So then people were arriving because there'd been an emergency call put out to the community. Get down to Webdock ASAP. If you're coming for the 5 p.m. rally, please come immediately because police are currently preparing to attack and clear the picket. People did come down in droves. That's why there was then a gathering on Sandridge Beach after the picket was finally successfully cleared by these cops that outnumbered picketers about 10 to 1. Of, you know, a gathering of about 150 people, because people, you know, the community had learned about this picket. They were they were at ready at the drop of a hat to mobilise. Unfortunately, you know, there wasn't there just wasn't time to get people down there, and people who were trying to get into the picket were being refused access to the area by police, in a way that, you know, I can't say this for sure from a legal point of view, but it seems to us that police did not have the power to do that.
Well, according to the Mel's legal team's testimony, which is the statement of concern policing of the web doc, which you can look at it, the Mel's website.
And I recommend it.
Recommend it, because it's absolutely staggering information, because, like, there's a section in it where it talks about the Mel's people, the legal observers, at one point are having reasonable discussions with higher level cops, while the people on the ground, the cops on the ground, and I would hazard a guess the critical response team, having had some experience of the critical response team, were basically doing whatever they liked. Indiscriminate use of what they call pepper, I call it tobacco spray. It's this horrible, horrible stuff. That just is just horrible stuff. And what's interesting, it's pointed out, is that the, and I think the police think this is what this pepper spray is. Like it says, legal observers recorded multiple uses of a pepper spray against people who were not posing any direct physical threat to police and were chanting, remonstrating, or attempting to communicate concerns to the police at the time they were sprayed. It appeared to the legal observers that on several occasions the spray was used as a coercive attempt to move people from an area. Now, that's not what it's for. It's for only supposed to be used if there's a physical threat and confrontation to the police, right? But I've got a suspicion that the police, in my experience, I've seen them use it just indiscriminately. And I think that they think that's what it's for because, you know, I've got the power.
That's right. And look, I can tell you from first-hand experience on a number of occasions that that is how police were using it even before this really calamitous and shocking attack. And I think attack really is the right term when you're talking about outnumbering the community 10 to 1. where the police finally did succeed. Of course they did, with numbers like that, in clearing the picket. But from the Friday afternoon, pepper spray was being used on people that were not even approaching police. And as you say, that's a really important distinction.
Yeah.
Pepper spray, or OC spray, as it's sometimes referred to, is supposed to be used to subdue someone who is posing a direct physical threat to an individual police officer, when in fact it's very clear, it's captured in a number of course, you know, the other thing about it, this being the social media age, is that everyone had their phones out. So there's plenty of evidence that the way that police were using the pepper spray was, you know, in a premeditated attempt to subdue and clear not physical threats to themselves, but the picket itself.
Yeah.
And I think a perfect example of this, and also one that, you know, might gladden the hearts of some comrades who are listening, is one of the chief commanding officers. So in any situation like that, there is a police person who is, you know, running the show, basically. They're the one to read the move-on order. They're the one that's supposed to liaise with the police liaison. We always had a police liaison down at the picket. I was the police liaison on a number of occasions. And, you know, that there were essentially two people that were running the show from the police side. One of them, Helena, I forget her last name, and alas, I didn't see this with my own eyes, but I think it was captured on film, was so indiscriminate with her use of her own pepper spray that at one point she sprayed it into the wind and it sprayed back into her own eyes. And, you know, not to be deterred, although she certainly was injured, she immediately, before being taken off to a police car to have her own eyes, you know, rinsed out, as we had to do as our medics team, including Riyad Aladasi, that I mentioned earlier, a nurse who was leading the community medic team down at the picket, you know, as we often had to do with comrades to help them clear that stuff from their eyes, from their hands and body, you know, because it burns the skin also. It's not just the eyes.
Yeah, it's really, unless you've actually seen this stuff, you don't realise. It's like pepper spray. It sounds like it's a, you know, yes, it would sting and it would be this light sort of airy sort of a puff into your face. But it's not. It's this it's this, you know, slimy
foam
stuff. It's a tentacle type thing. And it's a rusty red.
Yeah, that's right. And it's like the hottest chili you can imagine in liquid foamy form that gets in everything. It gets on your skin.
Yeah.
It gets on...
Very dangerous for people with...
So that then when you eat anything, you can, you know, that tastes spicy because it's you know, your fingers have touched it for a brief moment.
I'll interrupt you here because actually... this is really important. There were treatment areas were established to gather and treat injured people. These areas were chosen as they were located away from police lines and in public areas outside the Webb Dock area. Now, outside, not trespassing. One was established in a seated area along the Todd Road bike path. It was considered that this area was safe and allowed for injured people to gather and be treated by a small team of first aiders. Legal observers witnessed this area being suddenly charged and forcibly cleared by police without warning. Several first aiders were then sprayed with OC foam while attempting to regain access to the boxes of medical PPE and first aid supplies left in areas that were now behind police lines. Protest liaison and medics to regain access to their medical supplies were repeatedly denied by police, and it took over 30 minutes for senior officers to eventually provide the supplies. This was a tactic and a strategy.
That's right. That was a tactic and a strategy to clear what was obviously a good faith attempt to treat people injured by police activity, and which should be a protected endeavour, just like journalism, legal observation, like what MALs do, you know, on those kinds of sites, and any emergency services, including medics, should all be, again, under an international kind of human rights frame, as well as, to some extent, in Australian legislation, they should all be protected activities. And instead, VicPol just operates with impunity, treats everyone, you know, throws everyone in the same kind of negative basket of, like, you're a troublemaker, you're an activist, basically code for you're getting in the way of the flow of capital, and we're here to do the work of the state and of capital, which is to get you out of the way.
They actually arrested
of who you are and what you're doing.
They arrested a first aider.
That's right. And on top of all of this, they dragged someone out of a wheelchair.
Yeah, I know. And then they put a police line in front of them. The poor person was on the ground, surrounded by two lines of. They had. It's just staggering.
This was all captured on film. People can, I think, pretty easily access it on social media. I know that it was on the WACA page, Whistleblowers and Community Activists, I think it stands for. So if you go to ACCA_WACA on Instagram, I think you can send, you know, this video was widely shared. That person, you know, and I think that what you're raising about the treatment of medics and the treatment of people in, you know, in wheelchairs, people with serious accessibility needs, just being blanketly treated in the same brutal manner by VicPol really sums up their approach to this. And I think one of the takeaways, is that VicPol would not have acted in such desperate and violent ways if this picket had not constituted such a threat to the very powers that the police force exists to try to protect, and those powers are the powers of capital.
That's right.
When you're acting so desperately as to send, exactly, to nakedly admit, in effect, that you're going to throw literally everything you have at this one picket, you're going to call basically all the cops that are available down to Port Melbourne to outnumber picketers 10 to 1, to block access to a public space, well, to a space that the public has access to until such a time as those individual members of the public are told by the Port Authority that they are trespassing, which those people were not told because they haven't yet entered the site and they were being blocked from entering the site and standing with their comrades in solidarity by Victoria Police under what I understand at least to be, you know, illegal operations. But, you know, we know that the police regularly stretch the, you know, what's established as within the law, particularly
well, that's
when it
why
comes
you have
to moving
Mals.
On. Well, that's right. Thank God for Mals.
Yeah, thank God for Mals.
But, you know, they are acting, you know, to act in such a desperate way really bespeaks, I think, the impact of this picket, which by the time it was cleared, so Friday afternoon, Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, Monday afternoon, that's Saturday, Sunday, Monday. That's more than three full days. So more than 72 hours. That picket successfully prevented the access by land gates anyway of Wharfies to that site. And it meant that the Zim ship had to stay at anchor. It couldn't even dock because the ships that were at berth couldn't be loaded up to get out and allow the Zim, Ganges was the name of the ship, space to come in. That desperation on the Monday afternoon, I think, really bespeaks the really unimaginable success of that community picket in stopping work at that site. Mm. Other features of what occurred that similarly, I think, speak to how desperate the situation got for the flow of capital at that site was that by Sunday night, having repeatedly failed to collaborate with VicPol to force workers to cross the picket line by land, the bosses of the terminal decided, all right, we're going to ferry the workers in secretly, literally by night, we're going to fly them in by night by ferry from Spotswood directly to the dock part that we didn't have, we couldn't block that because it's behind the gates, right? So we were successfully blocking access to the work site by land.
Yeah, you'd have to be on the other side at Spotswood.
Well, right, we would have had to get to Spotswood. Yeah. We would have had to know it was happening. We would have had to try and then picket a third.
But what you're really saying,
on the other side of the Yarra. Yeah.
But what you're really saying, Ben, is that this isn't over. It's in the sense that this is going to be a lot of hell for the Vic Pol because this is not over. And also they brought police. They brought horses as well, didn't they?
That's right. On Monday afternoon.
Yeah, horses.
They brought horses and, we had...
That's what I always say that, when you're at a demonstration, oh my God, they brought in the horses.
Yeah, and it's an opportunity for that, for what is to my ear like one of those great Australian protest chants, which is get those animals off those horses.
That's exactly right.
And we hear, don't we, genocidal intent in the discourse of Israeli politicians and fearmongers.
Yeah.
Saying we're fighting, who are we fighting in Gaza? We're fighting human animals.
Oh, it's outrageous.
When police are coming in and, at 10 to 1 on horseback and with indiscriminate use of pepper spray and violence, clearing a picket that consists by that point of, young people, people with mixed abilities, people of a range of different genders, many of whom are vulnerable. When they're treating them in that way, they are really the animals in that situation. And you're right that it's not over. It's not over for Vic Pol in terms of the legal consequences of the way they behaved on that day. It's not over for the broader question of policing powers. We saw in New South Wales the first serious attempt at a picket at the docks in Sydney was cleared with extreme violence. Many arrests were made under the even more punitive powers that police have in quote-unquote protected areas in New South Wales after recent legislation was passed. That raises all kinds of questions for the future of police powers in Victoria and the way that it's being mobilised to, try to cut this incredible community activism that we've been seeing since October 7th, to try to cut that off at the knees. And it's not over for the bosses. It's not over for Zim Shipping. It's not over for any terminal in Victoria or around the country that chooses to continue to do business with genocide ships. Because that is what Zim Ships and any affiliate ships now categorically are, and however violent and desperate police might be and continue to be to try to ensure that capital continues to flow through those sites on and off those ships, the community, unionists, activists of all kinds of political stripes and all kinds of, a range of ages and genders from, we had children as young as 5 at the picket, we had elderly women, many of them, at a political action of this kind for the first time in their lives, they're going to continue to be showing up. And they're going to be showing up in larger and larger numbers. And the fact is that when you have 200 people at a picket like that, or 300 people, or 1,000 people, which is absolutely within the realm of possibility, we have tens of thousands regularly at the Sunday rally. When you have that many people, the cops don't stand a chance. They can't touch a group that large. I mean, they can try, and they will continue to try, and they will continue to, behave in unjustifiable ways and ways which should be prosecuted, and I believe will be prosecuted as far as possible. But the community has already shown where it stands on this. The polling is extremely clear. People want the genocide to stop, and more, they are getting politically organized and involved for the first time in their lives and learning what it means to put their own bodies on the line to stop the flow of capital to that kind of genocidal, warmongering behaviour as we're seeing in Gaza and other places. And the thing I want to end on, Annie, if you will, is that at some point on Monday, after the picket was cleared, just before midnight, when they were preparing finally to bring the Zim Ganges into dock, having succeeded in sneaking workers in by ferry. They also considered using a helicopter, which a former MUA member and Wharfie told me they have actually done before. When I was dumbfounded and laughing, when we were laughing at the concept that they might have to helicopter workers in, he said to us, well, it wouldn't be the first time. They've done it before. So having snuck them in on Sunday night to load up that ship that was in the berth, get it out and prepare for the Ganges to come in, the Zim Ganges turned off its GPS tracking. Now, I'm no lawyer, but our understanding is that according to Australian and international maritime orders, a ship can only justifiably turn off its GPS tracking because this is a safety and logistics mechanism that a number of different points of the, workforce kind of use, and it's used to keep people safe on and off ships. It's only justified in turning that GPS tracking off when the company running that ship believes there is a genuine safety or security risk posed to the ship. The only other place that we know that Zim Shipping regularly has been doing this, turning off its GPS tracking, is off the coast of Yemen. Now, the community picketers at the docks in Port Melbourne, who will continue to turn up, whether it's Port Melbourne Web Dock, whether it's Swanson Dock in West Melbourne, whether it's docks on the other side of the river and docks all over the country, the people will continue to be turning up and saying, not in our name, you won't be getting into work to load or unload this genocide ship. They can try to spin that as a security concern for the ship itself, but what the truth is that they try to go dark to hide what they're doing. But what you get is this hilarious situation where on the GPS tracking, you have the tugboats that are necessary to bring the ship in. Their GPS has been turned off. So the ship sitting at anchor, it suddenly disappears. And then, two tugboats several tugboats come to the ship and start to guide it into the dock. But as far as Zim is concerned, the community picketers might as well be Houthi rebels. And they are scared, and they are trying to cloak their operations in darkness and claiming that it's a security and safety concern for the ship. Well, I can tell you that it's certainly a concern for the unimpeded flow of capital that is directly funding, aiding, and abetting a genocidal campaign in Gaza, and while that continues, the so-called safety or security concern constituted by a picket of concerned citizens at any dock that is prepared to receive those ships will continue.
Thank you very much for talking to us this morning, Ben.
Such a pleasure, Annie, and thanks for your show that does so much, I think, to galvanise the movement. And if people are interested in getting involved in this, any union member is able to participate in the political organising run by Unionists for Palestine. Check out our Instagram and Facebook presences. You can easily contact us that way. There's an email address, which I don't know off the top of my head, but we're easy to contact. And if you're not in a union, then follow Free Palestine Melbourne and
APAN. You haven't turned your GPS. You haven't got rid of your GPS.
Right.
Everybody can find you.
Absolutely. We're all over social media where we're doing we're necessarily doing, all of us, the reporting that the ABC and the mainstream media refuse to do. We saw last night that when the ICJ ruled as strongly as it could have ruled.
That's right.
Ready immediately, the entire media globally swung into action, trying to spin this story as ICJ stops short of calling for a ceasefire.
Yeah, that's right.
A ceasefire is not something that the ICJ could have called for, given that Palestine was not a party to the legal case. The ICJ said almost unanimously and certainly unequivocally that what is occurring in Gaza is a genocide and Israel must stop doing it. That is the reality, that is the legal reality, and that is the basis for people to continue the incredible mobilization of community activism that we've seen in the last 112 days, I believe it is now.
Yep.
It will continue. And it's a movement like we've not seen in Australia and around the world. But, you know, we're talking on the ground in terms of community pickets and community activism in concert with unionism, with the trade union movement, which is, you know, in some cases slowly being dragged to this position by that community. But, you know, we have the vast majority of public sentiment behind us, and we will continue to work to bring our unions along. But you know, that is the reality now. It is a genocide. It is apartheid. It is an illegal occupation. And this is, you know, the kinds of political organizing that we're seeing right now. It's what we've been, you know, it's what people have been dreaming of for decades. So that's a gift. As there are so many gifts that the Palestinian people, I think, have given us over the years. They've continued to be this beacon, this example of resistance to colonial occupation and violence. And, you know, in terms of the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign, for instance, I also encourage your listeners, if they haven't checked out BDS, to, you know, hop online and see what they're about. That is an absolutely crucial and historic kind of attempt to organize anti-capitalist resistance across the world in the name of the defense of the Palestinian people. And the genocide that has been perhaps a bit more slowly and now, you know, really urgently, but has been occurring against them since before the Nakba, since before 1948, when Israel's illegal occupation of historic Palestine began.
We have to leave it there. We're right up to the edge of the time frame for
right
this program.
Thanks so much, Annie. Really
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.